Talk given Saturday, 30th April, 1983. I am very happy to greet you all here today. I actually consider it a privilege and an honor to be asked to speak to you. I believe there are many links between yourselves and me. We are all interested in the living of the religious life, the good life in the real sense. We are all concerned with the state of the world as it is. We have our ideals of worshipping and serving God or the Supreme or whatever name we like to use, and serving our fellow men as the expression of that which is deepest in our nature throughout our life. Now, the living of the religious life has so many meanings. We need not touch upon what the world considers living the religious life. It is somewhat akin to a morning suit in the morning and a lounge suit here and evening dress there, and that's as far as it goes, more or less, where the world as a whole is concerned. But those of us who are deeply concerned with it realize that it implies, first and foremost, the understanding of our own self, which comes about particularly through the purification of our whole psychophysical being. This prepares us, so to say, for beginning to sense that which we call the beyond, that which is transcendence. In each one of us, there is dormant this sense of transcendence. And from our childhood onwards, that is assuming that our parents were religiously inclined, we have been conditioned to accept the idea of that which is transcendent to us, that which created us, and that which we must serve throughout our lives. And of course, throughout the world and throughout the millennia, various carrots have been held out for living the good life. Also, rather terrible consequences have been held up for living the bad life. And so, man, throughout the ages, has undergone much conflict within himself. And only a few have realized in a very real way what is the meaning of living the good life. There are a great many people nowadays who are concerned with helping our fellow human beings as an expression of living the good life, and linking ourselves, our fellow human beings, to whatever we consider is the source of our being. Now, the influence which we have upon our fellow human beings depends mainly upon what we ourselves are. Now, we ourselves strive to be pure and truthful and loving and so forth, but that striving is in accord with preconceptions of what purity, morality, goodness, love all mean. And this is where it is easy to fall down and make our mistakes. Having these preconceptions and various assumptions as to our personal relationships in our own sphere and with the world and with transcendence. They are, if we really care, we would examine everything with a completely open mind, with a flexible mind. I don't mean, therefore, with a mind that is gullible, ready to swallow anything that appeals to something in us. We have to beware very strongly about this appealing to us, because we all have this pleasure-pain drive and our own peculiar preconceptions and assumptions about ourselves, practically none of which have any warrant in truth in the ultimate sense. So it is important that the mind should be absolutely open in order that our life from moment to moment may become such that the psyche undergoes complete purification. As and when the psyche undergoes complete purification, what we call transcendence, or God, or whatever name you like, begins to have the chance to utilize us as the apparatus for manifesting its own transcendent power, goodness, etc., etc. But remember that all these names which I am using, power, goodness, and so forth, are something utterly different applied to transcendence, applied to God, in God. The godly state is truly an utterly transcendent state. We use these words, and if you examine all the words that have been used in all the religions, you will find that they all apply to man. What man has done is to apotheosize, maximize the meanings of these names according to his little intelligence and apply them to God. But God is God, the absolute unknown and unknowable, excepting insofar as the shadow of that transcendent reality makes an impress upon our own psyche, and we just begin somehow, somewhere, somewhen to thrill to that. I always say that the religious life begins with saintship. Now, that may be a difficult pill to swallow. It begins with saintship. When we as psychophysical individuals are free of the necessity of studying religion and religious teachings, then we are really beginning to live religiously. The scriptures can all be put aside. And in the process of growing in that living of the religious life, the inner meaning of the scriptures comes to light, more and more. The transcendent light is entirely different from the intellectual light, from the light of the genius. It is the light that is like a lightning stroke which does not slay but liberates you absolutely and utterly into a totally different dimension of being possible to man. Here too we have to beware, because as and when some of us do experience that in our life, as and when that happens, we tend to think, we are there. We are not there. There is no there. It is all here, now. Hyphenate the two words, and you get, and if the brain can be quiet, and the brain is a terribly noisy chatterer, if the brain can be quiet, and the sense of the here-now begins to thrill in your inner consciousness, innermost consciousness, you suddenly wake up to the fact that as we are here and now, we function in terms of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. But this finitude, temporality and mortality, is suddenly transmuted into infinity, eternity. Immortality, of course, necessarily is included in eternity. That is the real beginning of the religious life. Because then this rather pathetically obtrusive, egoistic, I is the good dog who's been properly trained. And he does exactly what his master wants him to do. It's only the beginning. I often suggest the analogy of an electric bulb. The energy is electricity, right? But it needs an apparatus through which it can function. It may be an electric bulb, it may be a dynamo, it may be anything you like that, you see, an instrument. But without the instrument, that power doesn't work. The purpose of our existence is to be such instruments of transcendence. And in order to be such instruments of transcendence, we cannot tell transcendence, I am so and so, I am like this, that and the other. Oh God, do this for me and function like this through me. And the Lord God says, well, we'll see. Carry on. So we can't dictate to that, but that completely subsumes us and interpenetrates us, but never compels us. That is the difference between God and the devil. The devil suffers from compulsiveness. God doesn't suffer from anything like that. When I wake up to the fact, to start with, that I am the devil, a veritable devil, because I'm clever enough to twist things round in terms of the language I know and the thoughts I have, to make God fit into me, forgetting that it is this which has to fit into the transcendent. So when we awake to reality, to transcendence itself, in deeper and deeper measure, in greater intensity, we must be careful not to think that we are climbing a ladder to heaven or some such thing. Heaven is here. Just as hell is here. So we have to bear all that in mind very, very carefully. Otherwise, we expend our energies in serving our fellow human beings in the ways we think they ought to live and so forth. So you get your militant evangelists and all that kind of nonsense. The real serving of our fellow men is in terms of what we actually are. Because what we actually are, the psychophysical being, which is the apparatus for the universal spirit, this psychophysical being is constantly radiating that which has become a realization in it. Insofar as the sense of transcendence has woken up in me, it spreads a light. It's like the sun in the sky, the sun in the heavens. It just burns away. It doesn't tell the earth or the other planets or anything what to do or anything on this earth. It has no special, it has no vested interest. God has no vested interest in us at all. God is the absolute totality. And the absolute totality can have no vested interest in any part of it. If you want to say that it has a vested interest, right? The vested interest is totality. And therefore, it doesn't make any separations between this person and that person, between this situation and that situation. If I'm not mistaken, isn't it in Revelation that it is said, Book of Revelation, that Satan will be let loose for 1,000 years? And then he has to go back to his proper place. Well now, God never destroys Satan. It's a very significant thing. And in Zarathustrianism, it is stated that Ahura Mazda created two spirits, twin spirits. They are twins. The word used is mainyush. Now, mainyush can be translated as spirit. It can also be translated as mind, two minds. If we apply that to us ourselves, there we have, some 35 centuries ago, the first teaching of the ambivalence of the human psyche. Now, that is quite earthily real for us. The psyche is ambivalent. But I believe that there is a profounder significance involved in it all. Because transcendence not only creates, but in order that the work of creation may go on, fulfilling transcendence's own transcendence, so to say, there has to be an element which removes that which is outworn and that which has been worked out. For instance, take an analogy like this. We go to school, start with the kindergarten. Then we emerge into the junior school. Then we go to the secondary school. Then we might go to the university. Then we might become researchers on our own and let genius blossom out if the good God has gifted us with it. It is like that with God himself. In a divine sense, I mean, these analogies absolutely fail and fall down after, if they help us suddenly get a flash, then that flash cleanses our being in a Now, I mentioned that stuff, eternity of infinity. All of us know those words. How many of us are really conscious infinity of immortality? See, we are imprisoned in all the verbal process of our minds, quite imprisoned there. An idea, a belief, a conviction is more or less impotent as compared with a clear and enlightened consciousness of something. Take, for instance, the one experience at least which is common to all mankind, falling in love at a certain age, most of it. And all our conceptions of love arise, our desires and our beliefs, so on and so on. But when one is truly conscious of it, will naturally, spontaneously, inevitably, and invariably express itself as true love through all our thought and feeling, through our speech and actions. What you are truly conscious of is expressed without let or hindrance throughout the whole psychophysical organism. Now we can't aspire to that. We can't say, I will start right now, I am so enthused. I'll start right now and cultivate. You can't cultivate. You know why? This is divinity embodied. And it is embodied through its own deliberate self-restriction. Now this is very hard to sort of get at, really. Transcendence restricting itself produced manifestation in terms of existence, a standing out of. But in that standing out of, actually, the whole transcendence interpenetrates that which has stood out of it. It itself has expressed, pushed out of itself, all existence. You see, this is where grace, the mercy and mystery of transcendence comes in. God descended into matter, so to say. You don't mind my using Christian terms because you people aren't you? You see. Descended into matter by deliberate self-restriction. That's the meaning of the cross. And then, having descended into matter, because it's essential divinity is caught up there, that divinity acts persuasively to enable matter to develop and become life, mind, consciousness. And by the time it has become consciousness in the real sense, well, in our sense even, our innermost consciousness is something which is the Supreme itself embodied there. The brain does not know it. The brain makes thought forms. What are thought forms? Verbal forms which have some sort of meaning for us. they give us some sort of satisfaction, some sort of impetus, and so forth. But mere thoughts about God are nowhere near the real consciousness of the divinity. If you meet a person who has at least the first thrillings of this consciousness of the divine, you will, if you have the sensitivity, you will experience a peculiar something. This fellow, he's different. What is there about him which is like that? And you know how in the lives of the religions and of all true teachers, of all true spiritual teachers, this has been experienced by those who came in touch with them. And so there was no question. They knew the person, if he had the sensitivity, yes, that's it. But unfortunately, so many who have that experience say, now I have found. And you see, then there's a full stop. There's no full stop whatsoever, anywhere. We like a full stop because we are enslaved by our desire for security. Ah, at last I've got my, this is my house, this is my car, this is my wife, this is my son. My bank balance is always black, never red, etc. What nonsense. All existence changes. Its unchanging characteristic is perpetual change. Changing characteristic. So to seek security in our sense is to seek to fossilize. We do that successfully by dying and not being cremated, then the bones will fossilize. So now, if something like a touch of this consciousness of divinity, this consciousness of the context of divinity, infinity and eternity, thrills, then the religious life truly begins. Shall try another and a person is born with a gift to play a piano. We'll see. He practices his scales and arpeggios and studies and this and that. He learns his and all the rest of it. He learns the works of the great composers. And when he's young, coming out, he thrills everybody. His virtuosity and so forth. But as the years go by, even if the virtuosity, the sheer technique begins to diminish a little bit, he is able to say something profounder and profounder, influence you accordingly. So you see, it is an endless process. This we must bear very carefully in mind. But when he has sort of, as the world would say, attained, and he is now coming to his own as a supreme concept, pianist and so forth. Now he's beginning his musical life. Until then, it worked up to that fruitive point. How many human beings in the world, throughout the millennia, throughout the ages, have ever reached the fruitive? We don't know of the distant past, but during the last 6,000 years, we have one Zarathustra, one Krishna, one Buddha, one Mahavira, one Jesus Christ, one Muhammad, and so on. And others whose names we don't know. There have been hundreds of others, but what are hundreds in proportion to the thousands of millions that have been born and lived and died during the last 3 or 4 years? But if we can appreciate this and sort of take the big view, have a really wide and distant horizon in front of us, then we will see that there is a developmental process. We'll begin to see the purpose of our existence. Then, of course, the brain starts intruding and saying, then what about all those people who didn't sort of see this? Let us not waste our compassion in the wrong way. In the spring, the leaves, the buds, they all come out. They come to the stage of bear fruit, flower, and so on. In the autumn, they start their movement of going back home. The tree remains, but all the leaves, all the flowers are gone, excepting for the evergreens and so forth. But generally speaking, that's what happens. Every leaf, every flower couldn't demand of the tree that I shall be a fruit. Can't do it. That will let be. Transcendence knows. Knows with a knowing which is uncluttered and not almost cursed with the sort of brain knowing that we have. Because our brain knowing is frightfully conditioned all the way through. We have to understand what we must let go. And this is the real asceticism. What is an ascesis? A process of letting go that which is unessential for the fulfillment of the purpose of our existence. The purpose of my existence will never be my purpose, mapped out by me, thought out by me, and so on. It happens. I have to let it happen. We are interferers with God. We are interferers with nature. We are interferers all along the line with humanity, with the animal world, with the plant world, and so forth. And we do it all in the name of benefit. Benefit who? Me. And I have the cheek to say, I'm trying to help you. To be quiet within oneself and let infinity cure us of our free us of our imprisonment in finitude. But knowing that infinity completely interpenetrates all finitude, that means that it interpenetrates every single particular throughout the whole cosmos, from an atom to a galaxy, from a virus to a perfected saint. It interpenetrates each and every one of them. And it's the whole of infinity, the whole of eternity, which interpenetrates every single particular. This is the mystery, the marvel of the divine. And this is something very little which an ordinary mortal like me, as the Catholic might say, born in sin, like me, can sort of begin to sense. Then what must be the reality with the one, the Holy One, who is the perfected Holy One on earth? And we have said they are sent by God to help us, to teach us, to redeem. But look at the way they tried to redeem us. By being what they were, the influence of the living being, as he is, without his attempting to influence anybody or anything else, is the most powerful influence that we can exert for good. Then we are truly meek. Praos. Tamed and trained. That's a beautiful Greek word, praos, isn't it? The colt which was caught, he was first tamed. Then he was trained, and then he became the obedient servant of his master. Now, in our case, there's nobody to catch us and tame us and train us. We have to do it ourselves. Why? Because perhaps one of the purposes of the existence of the human species is that the divine is trying to release so many divinities which will naturally and spontaneously live and work in accord with the transcendent itself. The particular manifestation will now have become completely merged with that which is beyond both manifestation and unmanifest, and the unmanifest. And to me, this is the greatest and best influence which can go out through us as the unresisting apparatus of the divine itself and help our fellow beings. Otherwise, we inevitably try to condition other people according to our conditioning, according to our petty views, our little views, and so forth. Our evaluations, our values. Notice. I suggested how if we are truly conscious of love, then love in its divine perfection will naturally, spontaneously function through our whole thought and feeling, our speech and our action. Now that way, it is God who redeems his own infinite manifestation. We have to awake to that. This is the meaning of enlightenment. Nothing to do with ideas, systems of philosophy, or anything like that. If, by the grace of transcendence, you are struck with that flash of lightning, you will find suddenly a complete release from everything that binds, both the bad and the good in us, they all bind. You know, there was a great Marguerite Porete, I think, was the mystic. And she was burnt at the stake for all that. She said, "Virtues, I take leave of you." Yes, I think she was the authoress of the Mirror of Simple Souls. "Virtues, I take leave of you." The Buddha said a similar thing. In the Upanishads, you will find the same sort of thing. You take leave of all your virtues. What does that mean? That which was evil, harmful in us, has now been cleansed out of us, the positively evil and so forth. Right? Now we live what the world would call, not unjustifiably, the virtuous life. Here is a man who lives a virtuous life, and so forth. But there comes the point when our virtues are also just cloaks. Before the soul can stand in the presence of the Supreme, it has to divest itself of all that covers it. Sometimes I like to compare us human beings with the suits we wear. Each of us wears suits, clothes, all right? We outgrow certain clothes from childhood onwards. Then there comes the time when the suit is really outworn, it's folded up for the last time, or whatever happens to it, and so forth. Transcendence is continuously wearing suits. Us human beings. The flowers, the trees, the animals, everything that is manifest, those are the suits of transcendence. But transcendence folds each of these suits forever, for the last time, when it has completely served its purpose, its usefulness. This is not a utilitarian view, but something like that seems to me to happen with the work of creation and so forth. So then, if we can completely give ourselves to this working of transcendence throughout all the manifested universe, we will realize, if we can truly give ourselves, we will realize that there is nothing whatsoever for me, the separate individual. This is one of the things that in certain parts of the world it is impossible for them to give that up. Oh no, I persist through all time. God created me, and I, as such, persist through all time forever and ever, which is a mistaken notion. Time will never be forever and ever. Eternity is something quite different from time. It is also different from timelessness, because timelessness is a human experience, bounded by time at each end. One enters into the experience of timelessness at a certain place, a certain moment, goes through that experience, and then emerges out again. Why? Because the organism has certain needs which simply cannot be denied. The Buddha declared he could stay in the supreme meditative condition, which in Buddhism is called the cessation, for 7 nights and 7 days without moving. But after that he had to move, otherwise the body would die. And if the body dies, there is no psyche. We think what we call the soul, etc., is imperishable. Nothing of the sort. The imperishable is the unknown to us, knowable to God. But that knowing never makes any thought forms. There are no conceptual processes going on there. Conceptualizing and verbalizing is the ball of thread which we use to tie ourselves up in all our little ideas. There's nothing like that in them. The origin is constant creative action, which has no consequence in our sense of the word. And for us, as individuals, there is neither reward nor punishment as such. When we really see that there is nothing for us to attain or achieve, but for us there is everything to shed, to let go all that which preserves the self-constriction of transcendence by itself. And when that happens, well then, the perfect thing has happened. But I will never know it as such. Never know it with the brain. It's impossible for the brain to know it. And you see, we are the most advanced psychologists and religious thinkers of the day have got trapped is in examining the brain and the activity of the brain as such, as mind. Pure mind is just a universal energy. That is to say, it is not an energy as such. It is the expression, one archetypal expression of the primordial creative energy in action. Acting that way, it is mind, it is consciousness, supreme consciousness. Acting this way, it is what we call, they are only words to us, transcendent love. Acting this way, it is purity. Acting this way, it is goodness. Acting this way, it is beauty, sheer beauty. But you see, the brain does all this. Like some composers who have written so many notes that it is rather difficult to hear the music. Well now, I hope that I have succeeded in perhaps upsetting you a little bit. Because you see, when one is upset and falls down, one has to pick oneself up. And the act of picking oneself up is the most valuable teacher which we have in life. So I'll leave you with that for today. Thank you all very much for coming and being so patient and listening.